Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now, imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and once again, I'm joined by Cam Maitland and Alicia Fletcher, and this is the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite.
2007 really wasn't all that long ago, and as such, it's difficult for us to see some of the historical markers that have revealed themselves in some of our earlier episodes. But one of the big trends we can see is that people were really into dark and gritty stories. When you look at some of the biggest movies of the year, you're seeing people go to Zodiac en masse. This is a really violent movie about serial killers, and also, weirdly, a very boring movie. There's also No Country for Old Men, again, a very dark, gritty kind of film, and of course, Sweeney Todd. Even kids' movies like Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix ends with the downer of Sirius Black's death and the fact that Gary Oldman isn't in the movies anymore, so why watch them? There's television, too. You're looking at CSI, Criminal Minds, and, of course, Dexter being, like, the biggest thing, which started another debate in my house of whether or not that show is good. It's going to be a whole thing. Anyway, why do you guys think people were into these, like, super vicious movies that's still going for now?
I think we were super depressed.
Sure.
I mean, we're going to get into that today. We've got some stuff coming.
Yeah, yeah. I also just think it's a thing that it always is. You know, people always love seeing dark things. But what you're talking about is, like, the third and fourth movie of a lot of series. I think you start running out of ways to make it interesting. Without it going super dark. I mean, also, just when you look, honestly, it's a part we've cut out of the show, but when we were looking up, if you look up history, for instance, Canadian history, most of the memorable things tend to be very dark stuff. For instance, I will say, in 2007, people might remember that feet started washing ashore in British Columbia.
Oh, yeah.
Severed feet.
In single like shoes, right?
Yes.
Like that was the whole thing, yeah.
And we've never really figured it out. We think it's just dead bodies they come off of automatically. Yeah, dark stuff is memorable too, because there's plenty of dopey, you know, Ratatouille, Transformers. we just remember National Treasure, The Book of Secrets, Alicia's favorite, I'm sure.
I've never seen it.
Mr. Bean's Holiday.
I've seen that and I love it.
these great films like Norbit, they're all here, but I think for some reason we don't remember them as much.
Mm-hmm. Well,
you know?
As we discussed previously, there's like a weird line we have for our award shows where we're like, we're going to award the like dark and dramatic, horrible stuff, but here is our line. Like we don't give it to horror, but we do give it to Zodiac, right? Like it's a very strange thing.
I think there's...
It should be said that I love Zodiac and I think Alicia does too.
I do, so yes.
We will not stand for your Zodiac bashing.
I think there's a moment to a pivot in studios where they realize that even if something gets rated R or higher, it didn't actually mean that much of a decrease in box office. Like in some ways, there's a cachet to it being very violent and very sexual and very dark that, you know, this could actually spell long-term, not immediate, but long-term box office success by being so notorious.
Actually, interestingly, to go back an episode, Stephen Sondheim talks about how he thinks Silence of the Lambs really changed things.
Yeah.
Because he said that, you know, if somebody could see this guy who ate people and be like, I'm on his side. He's like, from then on out, you could write any character.
That's a great point.
I actually think that concept of the artist as serial killer is very, very relevant to our first movie. We're going to talk about that one. And I believe we have mixed reviews on this one as well. But I think the best way to think about this is if there is a book you guys had as a kid that like really stuck with you, that you like not only related to it, but like it inspired you. Because mine was Franny and Zooey by Salinger, which will also be relevant later on.
Oh, me? Do I have one?
Yeah. Do you guys have anything like that? That was like, yes, this book, this is my new Bible.
The Adventures of Cavalier and Clay was probably like that for me. The Michael Chabon.
I don't know. I guess my big ones were like Moby Dick and the life and opinions of Tristram Shandy.
Which is why you went on your whaling expedition at age 12.
Exactly. That's why I always think about taking to the sea when I'm depressed.
Don't we all, Cam? Don't we all? I mean, we've seen By the Sea. We can see how it can be so lovely. Yeah. That having been said, there is a book that mega superstar Kurt Cobain of Nirvana, he had a novel from 1980s Germany that he felt incredibly strongly about.
I've read Perfume by Patrick Susskind about 10 times in my life, and I can't stop reading it. It's like something that's just stationary in my pocket all the time. It just doesn't leave me, and every time I'm bored, like I'm on an airplane or something, I read it over and over again because I'm a hypochondriac, and it just affects me. It makes me want to cut my nose off.
And it seems like an awful lot of people read, loved, and related to Perfume. It's the second biggest selling German novel after All Quiet on the Western Front. It's one of those books that like seems like it is unfilmable, and maybe even though a movie has been made of it, it might still be unfilmable. Let's talk about Perfume, Story of a Murderer, and perhaps one of the biggest, who is this movie for and how did it get such a huge release movies we've talked about. Alicia, let's talk being orgied out of existence.
Yeah, so I should say I read Perfume upon Kurt Cobain's recommendation quite early in my life, and it probably far too early. I was way too young to understand it, and I read it again in my 20s, and I'm a huge fan of this book. And it's about a serial killer in, it's pre-revolution France, which is very, very important to the story, actually. And it's directed by Tom Teichfer.
For everybody's sake, we have looked up how to pronounce this. We are like 90% sure that's what it is, so that's what we're going with.
Depending on how German you want to be, it's Tickver or Tickver.
I'd say Tickver. I went to the Berlinale when he was the head of the jury, that name was just imparted on me because it's, of course, we say Tom Tyker basically in North America, and he's known for Run Lola Run, so he's a name that we all recognize. But I have second year university German, so I do think I might be an authority on this.
Go nuts.
Anyway, this takes place in Paris, although it's filmed mostly in Barcelona and other areas of Catalonia. And it's about a baby who is born into absolute drudgery in the fish market, becomes an orphan after his mother is hanged because she tried to kill him at birth. And then he has this incredible otherworldly sense of smell. He can smell anything, and not just like nice smells. The film makes very clear, and I think it does very effectively, how disgusting Paris would have been. And he ends up becoming an apprentice to a perfumier, which is, am I saying that right?
Yes, perfumier. That's correct.
Yeah, I'm sure if you want to get more French, you could get weirder.
Well, my pronunciations of all languages is terrible, including English. But and that's played by Dustin Hoffman. And he becomes obsessed with preserving essentially a visual or a feeling through scent. So he becomes enraptured by young women who would never really see him. He's very good at disappearing. This is played by Ben Whishaw. The character's name is Jean-Baptiste Grenouille.
The voice of Paddington, people. So this will give you a very different view.
As someone who is probably the Paddington franchise's biggest fan, I don't want to talk about the fact that that is also Ben Whishaw. I love Ben Whishaw. And this is one of his earliest roles. He was really a newly discovered talent. He starts killing women, young, beautiful women, and tries to distill their scent. And so he becomes effectively a serial killer. And of course, the town, it's both takes place in Paris and in Graz, are terrified that their young women, their sisters, their daughters are being killed off. And so it becomes sort of a hunt down film. But what it does with scent, because how do you depict scent on film? Mm-hmm. It's easier to write about, and Susskind does a very good job in the novel. You know, when you can read words about what things smells like, memories come flooding back. And like, for me, scent is I think for a lot of people, scent is the biggest trigger to a memory. I can smell Wonder Bread, because there's a Wonder Bread factory, I think, in Leslieville. And when I smell that, I am instantly taken back to my grandmother's bread drawer in her 1930s little, you know, house where if you pulled that drawer open, you would smell like 70 years of Wonder Bread. And I don't eat Wonder Bread myself, but like that smell makes me so happy because it reminds me of my grandmother. How do you put things like that on film? And so as much as I think we're going to talk about perhaps this film being at times atrocious, I think Tom Tykwer tries and does yes. quite a good job of depicting scent on film.
I will give you that this film is, number one, absolutely gorgeous. This is a beautiful
Stunning.
Movie. Mm-hmm. Number two, I give it that it was marketed very strangely. Mm-hmm. It's marketed to be mm-hmm. almost like a 50 Shades of Grey, very sexy
like
sort of
S&M,
film.
Yeah, like BDSM.
Yeah.
I can imagine like all of these bored suburban housewives going to this movie, expecting to be titillated. And then the first scene happens where this newborn baby is dropped into a bunch of fish guts as dogs are pulling it apart. Like 90% of my notes are like, this is gross. This is gross.
It's
this is
gross. Gross.
Yeah. Because that visual is also part of the scent. If you feel gross, you're like, yeah, that would smell gross. Like it sort mm-hmm. of adds to that. Mm-hmm. But I just love the idea of these women just like staring in silence and everyone looking at each other being like, should we go? Like, what is
yeah.
this? And one woman being totally into it.
And I think as a period film, period films tend to attract a certain demographic. You know, this looked like it could have been Dangerous Liaisons, and it very much isn't. I would actually say that this is probably one of the biggest anti-romantic films that
sure.
you could really conceive of. And so I do think it had a huge marketing pitfall. Like, I don't know how. I'm glad I wasn't the publicist on this film back in the day.
Apparently, it was hugely marketed in Germany and very successful.
Well, they're
Germans.
Europe.
We know what the Germans, they
sure.
understand this.
I mean, it's also worth saying that we are saying this movie isn't very sexy, yet it features one of the largest orgies
two
ever
orgies,
depicted on film.
Two orgies, yeah.
Consisting of 750 people for that one, which
yes.
is wild.
Only 100 orgies.
Yes,
but
750
saying,
people.
But 750 overall.
Tom Tykwer,
many
in
nude.
Casting the orgy, which I'm sure was a fun process, went to a dance troupe, a very famous avant-garde dance troupe. Mm. And so the orgy, which is the climax of the film, see what I did there, is slow motion. So you're really seeing body movement, and it makes sense to me that these are avant-garde dancers. It's very well done. And then there's a second orgy, which I don't think will spoil. It's much darker and...
Yeah.
You know, is sort of the resolution of the film. It looks so, so beautiful. It was the most expensive German film up to that time. It might actually still be. I'm not sure if something has topped it. And it's, you know, if we're looking at the Peter Susskind book, the source material, which was published in 1985, this has been passed along from director to director in terms of interest. Like at one point, Scorsese was going to adapt it. Miloš Forman, Stanley Kubrick before his death was interested. At certain points, this film, the screenplay, once it was approved for adaptation, was attached to Tim Burton, coming back to the previous episode of Sweeney Todd. It was attached to...
This is like Confederacy of Dunces style, like somebody's got to do this, but how the hell do you do it?
Yeah, Ridley Scott was attached. Julian Schnabel was attached, which of course instead he made in 2007, Diving Bell and the Butterfly, which has come up a number of times actually in this podcast.
Mm-hmm.
I think for me of that canon of incredible directors, I would want to see Julian Schnabel do this. With a less budget.
So apparently the script he wrote that's what he used the basis of to make Diving Bell and the Butterfly, because it was much more like stream of consciousness, things just happening. And we should also say like 90% of this movie is silent. Like there's there's like a little bit of dialogue at the beginning and then a whole bunch of action at the end.
And big
wild.
Stars are killed off quite quickly.
Yes.
I know. So I loved this film when I first saw it. Hadn't revisited it until this podcast. And now I am... concerned about my love of it. Like I'm looking back and I'm like, well, it was 13 years ago and I was in my early to mid 20s. How have I evolved in that time to an extent that I look at this film differently?
How has that changed for you, Alicia?
Well, I'm more aware of misogyny and I'm more sensitive to sexual violence against women. And so this film has all of those things.
It's a deeply misogynistic movie. This bothered me. Like, it genuinely upset me.
How could it not be, though? Because then I remember how much I love the book. And I do think this is quite a faithful adaptation of a book that is seemingly impossible to adapt. So I give it respect for that. I applaud that this film was made. I just don't want to have to talk about it ever again.
I would maybe argue that it kind of saves itself from being totally misogynistic by being more just misanthropic.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he hates men too.
Yeah.
He just doesn't kill them because they don't smell good.
I think a lot of it comes down to class. I think what both Tom Tykwer and Susskind in the book are interested in is gender is definitely there, obviously. But a lot of it is, you know, Ben Whishaw's character, Grinwy, is born into a subclass, essentially. When he's able to, because he can create any scent, he's able to manipulate people's perceptions of him and emotions. He's able to, when he eventually makes his masterpiece, his perfume, and this is what triggers the orgy scene, he's able, and he looks disgusting in this film. He grows up in a tannery, and this is really accurate. This is how most people would not survive, people, children, most children who are taken from orphanages or sold from orphanages and worked in tanneries in the 18th and 19th centuries didn't make it past 12. Like, that was their life expectancy. And the film makes a really good, he looks absolutely disgusting, like a monster, even though Ben Whishaw is such an attractive and adorable looking person. Like, his skin is stained in patches, and he's really a subclass of person. And I think that's more what it's about. And the women in the beginning that he attacks are women who were also in that subclass that no one would miss and no one would report. And then he works his way up.
The concept of the less dead for serial killers in the 60s and 70s, where, like, all these, I mean, specifically with the Green River Killer, this is my nerd point. The Green River Killer was killing predominantly sex workers, and so who cared, right? Mm. Like, that's kind of how this works.
Yeah.
But they're only caught when they kill, quote unquote, women we care about, which is horrible.
Yeah. I think also a thing you're reacting to is what we were talking about with, like, how it's shot. Like, Tom Tickford says, like, the problem with shooting a movie that's about scent is he's like, I can only point a camera at somebody's nose so many times. The unfortunate thing is the only way to depict the visual, because the thing is he's getting this scent off of women that he doesn't get off anyone else, and that's what makes him this obsessed maniac. And I think, unfortunately, the only way to do that in the style Tom Tickford's trying is to, you know, male gaze the
dehumanize
shit out of
women. These women, like, and reduce them literally to their parts. Like,
and super sexualize. Like, I think the interesting thing is you don't see in the way Ben Whishaw plays it that it's sexual,
but it is.
But unfortunately, I think the only way to, like, show off that these are beautiful, like, they're all model-y looking ladies.
Let's just talk about that.
They're all redheads, and I think the redhead thing, I don't know if that's in the book, but that's obviously a very sensual choice.
I was trying to
choice.
Remember that, and I could be wrong, and maybe listeners know better, but I don't believe. No, they're not all redheads. I don't believe that's a thing.
I would be surprised. I wouldn't be surprised if he changed it, because that's his whole thing. Like, also throughout the film, he purposefully has a very muted color palette. Mm-hmm. And then every time he smells something, he adds another color. So it's like, it's supposed to get more and more colorful till the end. So, it's just an unfortunate kind of side effect where you do have to really just gaze so hard. And I don't even know if there's a way around it.
This made me think so much about the film The Collector from 1965, which is a film I think people should see, because it is incredibly iconic, and it really changed the game in terms of the concept of the serial killer and how they were portrayed, because that is a empathetic view of a serial killer. It's a guy who captures a young woman and basically Stockholm syndromes her until she falls in love with him, and it's empathetic towards him.
Do we have it on Hollywood Suite right now?
I believe we ought to. So check our
listings. Like I said, it's something people should see, just to, like, because it is so necessary for film history. It got nominated for, like, a ton of Academy Awards. Like, it was very prestigious, and it's the first time we really started to think about the anti-hero in that way on film, in this particular way. And so, I mean, you see the same thing happening with, like, Hannibal Lecter in every variation of him. He's an artist, right? He's this intellectual. Yeah. In some ways, we do relate to him, even though he kills and eats people in horrible ways and manipulates them intellectually. And this has that exact same kind of thing. I just think it actually might be the Ben Whishaw performance that I just can't get, that because it's played so blank and almost animalistically, especially when he's hunting her down, when the Alan Rickman character is taking away the daughter he's obsessed with, and the way he hunts her down like an animal is just so uncomfortable for me that I really don't feel comfortable with.
Do you feel like he is romanticized? Because I don't feel like he is.
I think there are parts where where you are meant to empathize with him because of how bad his upbringing is and its excuses for why he is the way he is and his lack of moral character.
Maybe. If that was the intention on Tom Tykwer's part, it's a failure. Because one of the things I think is really interesting is I have no empathy for Grinwy. I do when he's a baby being discarded for the first 45 seconds of the film. I have no compassion or empathy for him. And I actually think that is perhaps a saving grace, because there's a lot of films about serial killers, or if we're coming back to, of course, Silence of the Lambs, that make the absolute point is to empathize with a monster.
Is that empathy in the book?
No.
It's not there. Okay.
Yeah, I don't know. It's like it's very point of view and like creepy. But I also, it's also worth saying that this, like, beyond him killing people, he's also, like, essentially cursed. Every person he ever meets a terrible fate that is not connected to him. They just die terrible ways. And that's why, like you say, famous actors get dispatched very quickly, because the minute Benoit leaves the scene, they get run over by a horse
cart
or something.
Kind of hilariously, they're dispatched.
Yes. Yes, very funny. And I mean, that's the funny thing is, like, Dustin Hoffman, apparently a huge Run Lola Run fan, had really wanted to be in a Tom Tykwer movie. And yeah, he's this silly character that's there for about 20 minutes and then his house collapses on him.
That scene with Dustin Hoffman was actually one of the first things they shot. Ben Whishaw received an interesting blessing, I guess, from Dustin Hoffman as soon as they were done shooting together.
On my last day of shooting with Dustin Hoffman, he said, "Thank you, Ben, and good luck. You're now making a silent movie."
If there's something to really praise this film for, it's the attention to detail. Like, just looking at, you know, the issue of costuming, they had to costume 1,400 extras and background characters, but also the lead characters. They had the costumes made in Bucharest and then shipped them to Barcelona, where they were setting up production, and had to then, like, grease up and dirty 1,400 beautiful costumes to look authentic to, because obviously in the 1760s, there were no washing machines. Yeah. That kind of thing is quite impressive. And I also like, maybe this is a spoiler, I like that the dog saves the day.
I can see that.
Oh, yeah. Great little lap dogs.
Pekingese.
I definitely wrote a note of that. Love all the tiny dogs.
Great tiny dogs.
Just living their lives. I also love the fact that this is the second time we have a film that you're like, why does this have the biggest budget in the world? It was to launder money.
Really? There you go.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Man fully went to jail on this movie.
Thank you, Cam. Cam coming in the clinch with the weird trivia. Let's go.
It was some sort of laundering state subsidies. And in 2007, the guy was, one of the producers was found guilty of multiple counts of tax evasion and sentenced to 6 years in prison. Probably the reason why the budget is so big, probably the reason why it is as long as it is with much producer oversight, is it seems like maybe they were doing a bit of a producers again and just didn't care. Though one of the major producers was just using it to essentially get government subsidies and use them on his own, which is wonderful. But I don't know. There's a lot of interesting stuff along the side of it, I think. It's very interesting. Like, again, this is really what made Ben Whishaw. He was on TV and stuff, and he had this big Hamlet production, which everybody loved, and that's what Tom Tykwer saw and cast him. I'm super obsessed with the fact that Terry Mueller made a perfume series based on this film.
Oh my God. But again, that leads into, like, who is this for? Like, what do they think the marketing is?
Apparently, the
so
very rich.
Oh my God.
If you have $700 for a limited edition set, which includes Paris in 1738, a virgin's navel, a clean baby, and leather perfume.
Jesus Christ.
God.
They were all sold. They're out there, though. That's an eBay auction I would get it.
I feel ill. So upsetting.
I liked learning so much about perfume.
Oh, good.
Sure.
I don't wear
it.
Yeah,
it is a great
I get
learning
migraines
about perfume.
From perfume, so I felt like I was getting a migraine even watching this film, but the craft of it and how they portray it, historically how it was made, I thought was fascinating.
I do want to bring it into Patrick Süskind just for a minute, because he, as we talked about, this film was, this book was considered unadaptable, and like everyone was chasing him for the rights. And Patrick Süskind actually wrote a movie in 1997 called Rossini about how annoying it was to have producers chase after him for the rights to his novels. Love that exists. That makes me very happy.
It's also worth saying that Tom Tykwer, I think, makes a business of adapting things that are considered unadaptable. He famously tried to launch Krzysztof Kieslowski's trilogy that he wrote but died before he could make with Heaven. He made Cloud Atlas with the Wachowski sisters. He often does novels that I think people consider hard. He's doing Babylon Berlin right now. He's a showrunner.
I watched
that.
I forgot about that.
Yeah, I mean, it's three different German directors there. It's a very everybody German is involved. But so he's kind of a, I think he kind of relishes the thought of adapting the unadaptable, whether or not this was a
which,
success.
As we heard in our Orlando episode, as Tilda Swinton says, if somebody says something is unadaptable, mm-hmm. you just might be on the right track for something good or not, mm-hmm. but maybe something good. At least you're doing something different, and that's what matters. Right?
I would love to see pioneering canonical German filmmaker Rainer Werner Fassbinder adapt this.
Okay.
He's dead, very dead, but I would love to see what he would have done
with
this.
Dig him up, get on it.
We'll just get his hologram version, it'll be fine.
Yeah. I don't want to know what smells that guy's after.
All right. Although this is like an unadaptable film, our next film is about like constant nonstop references and self-awareness. And that's very much a trend from the 2000s. I mean, we all feel clever when like we get the joke or we get the reference. I'm very much guilty of this. But in 2007, the most pop culture referencing self-aware filmmaker out there, and I'm not talking about Tarantino, he made a movie that contains a scene where the characters literally sit down and watch the movie. Movies they are parodying in that film. That movie?
Hello.
Hello.
This is Nick Frost. He's one of the most expensive props on the film.
Yeah, I am.
What have you done so far on Hot Fuzz?
Stunt, some gun work, and I ate two cakes. Two whole cakes.
I just love hearing Simon Pegg and Nick Frost say the word fuzz because I think it's delightful. Let's talk about Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, I mean, when you talk about unadaptable things, Edgar Wright feels deep in his soul that there kind of is no such thing as a great British cop film. And the concept of a British cop movie is on its face hilarious. So he wanted to make not only the great British cop film, but the great British country cop film. So he set out to make his follow-up to Shaun of the Dead with Simon Pegg in tow, continuing his Cornetto trilogy, as they call it, with this kind of silly, but not parody. He really wants to state that this is not a parody. This story of a hyper-confident police officer, kind of a switch from Shaun of the Dead, a lazy guy who can't do anything. Instead, this is an annoying guy who is too good at everything, who is sent to the country and has to first deal with just the boring life of being a cop in the country in England, but slowly begins to reveal an incredibly sinister kind of, I don't even know, Wicker Man-esque conspiracy in the tiny village in which he lives. And he ends up teaming up with Nick Frost, who's a dopey, the country policeman you expect, but who is obsessed with action movies. And of course, immediately falls in love with Simon Pegg's character because this guy is an action character come to life.
I also love that the only thing Nick Frost requested was that he got to name his own character, and he went with Daniel Butterman, which is delightful.
I can't tell if that story is real or not, but I love
it. I do too.
Yeah.
I'm standing by it.
This is very much... It's an action movie, it's a crazy comedy, and it's very much weirdly a love story between Simon Pegg and Nick Frost. Apparently, originally, there was a love interest, but they canned that character and just gave all of her lines to Nick Frost without changing a word. So it's this very charming story of these two buddies. Getting into a insane situation.
Like, Edgar Wright is a name that people will recognize. Same with Simon Pegg, like, very much a name. Nick Frost, not quite as much, but definitely Simon Pegg. Mm-hmm. And people need to remember that, like, they had just come off Shaun of the Dead, and Shaun of the Dead was huge. And so for this one, they got total carte blanche of, like, what movie do you guys want to make? And they were like, this. We want to make this. So their budget for this was significantly higher, which is why that back end last 15 minutes is bananas.
I love that back end.
And they got the actors they wanted to work with, too, like Timothy Dalton. Oh, we love Timothy Dalton.
Yeah.
It's amazing when you listen to interview clips about how excited people were that Timothy Dalton was there, because in North America, not as big a star.
Other people that come into your sort of subconscious, you start writing with that visual, and for some reason you don't think that you would ever get those people. And weirdly, Timothy Dalton's casting was a little bit like that. Is before we'd even approached him or even thought about approaching him in that slightly stupid way, kind of gone like a Timothy Dalton type. And then eventually kind of the very, you know, the, what should have been clearly obvious right at the start is to go, when did we get Timothy Dalton to play that part?
I remember when Tim started reading the lines, me and Edgar just looked at each other and went, like this because we knew we'd found a man.
He'd been doing TV and stuff, but he hadn't quite had a role as big as this. And I think this caused rather a comeback. Edgar Wright, when he was filming Scott Pilgrim in Toronto, he did all these kind of Toronto events. And I saw Edgar Wright do an introduction for Flash Gordon. And that's like one of his favorite movies. And he loves Timothy Dalton in it. And Timothy Dalton loves Flash Gordon, weirdly. Timothy Dalton is always like, people didn't get it. It was a joke. He's great to hear interviewed about it. So I think that they kind of had that click and they wanted Timothy Dalton from the start as this great smarmy bad guy, and apparently he is the most charming man on earth. He comes and does all his coverage even on days when he should be off. That, like, he literally shocked the entire cast and crew when he showed up one day and he's like, well, you know, I'm my character's in this scene, and they're like, but you're Timothy Dalton,
you don't have to be here.
Yeah, exactly. So he probably got a stand-in fired, but he's great. I mean, Jim Broadbent loved Shaun of the Dead so much that he was like, please put me in a movie. And
this is something I do have to bring up, is originally the character of the wife of Jim Broadbent's character's name was Iris, and he made them change it because he thought it was too much of a reference. And I'm like, do you know what movie you are in?
Are you aware of this?
The interesting thing is, it's so hard to stand up to Shaun of the Dead.
It's perfect.
Because Shaun of the Dead, I think, is just one of the most tightly written comedies almost in cinema
history.
It's perfect. Like, it's just a, yeah, it's a perfect film. And this doesn't quite come up to it, but the amount of things I do kind of quote in my head, including Jim Broadbent going, he had a great big bushy beard, like, always makes me laugh. And, like, I forget so much. Again, it's like, at least it's the joke a minute thing. There's every British comedic character actor you could ever think of. Everyone that was on Big Train was Simon Pegg. You've got a Oscar winner, Olivia Colman, as the rude, horny lady cop.
Steve Coogan.
I mean,
Martin Freeman.
Bill Nighy. Yeah.
Bill Nighy.
Yeah, Bill Nighy, who came for like two hours.
Stephen Merchant shows up too. He's the one with the swan. The swan is my favorite part of this whole
film.
Yes,
the evil
God,
swan.
I love this one.
Yeah, and I mean, you've got Kate Blanchett in an uncredited role where you can't even tell it's her. Peter Jackson in an uncredited role, you can't tell it's him. It's lovely. And I mean, it's down to the thing where he's so obsessed with these references where all these nice old people in the village you don't realize are character actors from British action movies that are just like forgotten. There's people from like Raiders of the Lost Ark and License to Kill and No Escape and The Equalizer.
We're talking about, this is like Enchanted levels of like deep dive stuff.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That I would never know ever in a million years. I mean, there's some references that are pretty obvious. And it's also crazy because this is an adaptation of a film. Like, I mean, yeah, for instance, Wicker Man, I said, there's a guy from Wicker Man. And you're just like, okay.
There's a lot of IMDb cross-referencing that had to occur figuring this film out.
It's worth going to the trivia on IMDb for this one. But it's interestingly also a... he was an amateur filmmaker of some acclaim, Edgar Wright, and this is actually an adaptation, more or less, of an amateur film he made called Dead Right, which it's the same original concept. He was just like, I want an action movie in Somerset.
But that's what got him the job for Spaced, isn't it? Dead Right got him Spaced.
Yeah, I believe so. And there's also Fistful of Fingers, I think, was a pretty big hit, which is his Western. So there's a full sequences adapted from that amateur film as well, including the whole supermarket showdown, which is one of the better action bits.
Tonally, for me, it's a fascinating movie because it straight up turns into a slasher movie with all the impalements on the back end.
If impalements are a trigger for you, do not watch this.
Don't do it.
Yeah, not all of them are deadly impalements. Some of them are just going to like...
No, some of them are living
impalements. Yeah, they're going to maim you a bit, but they're very uncomfortable.
Yeah, there's a lot of discussion about the gore, because it's quite a gory film,
super
actually.
Gory.
And they decide, which I remember is a big thing Brian Fuller said about Hannibal, which I don't think worked, where if you make the gore so nuts that it could never exist in real life... that makes it less scary.
Ask Peter Jackson about that.
Yeah, exactly.
let's have that discussion.
Though I think the guy's head exploding when the top of a church falls on him.
But that's a The Omen reference, isn't it?
Yes.
I mean, I guess. But it's also just the grossest thing in a more mainstream film you'll ever see.
What were your favorite deaths? Mine was the old lady who does the crosswords getting taken out by a hanging flower basket.
That's pretty good.
Sure. I mean, I like the woman who doesn't want more than one child in her shop and is like torn apart by children. Question mark. When many children enter her shop and kill her.
I don't know. For me, I think it's the death of the poor peace lily, that the peace lily gets used to take out the giant goon. I'm very into that.
Oh, yes,
yeah, that the peace lily is a character in this film.
I mean, it's It's just a strange movie. I guess it's always kind of hard to talk about comedy.
Well, this one I think is really notable for the fact the way it was marketed, because we talked about Wreck previously, that YouTube was a new thing, 2005, and people were still starting to kind of figure out how it could be used. And the internet was also a big thing for marketing. People were still trying to figure out what the potential was to spread this stuff. And we talked a little bit about Paranormal Activity, but we didn't talk about how it was marketed and how genius that marketing was that the trailers didn't show any footage from the film. They just had hidden cameras in the theater that showed audience reactions and how bad people were freaking out of this movie. I went to see that movie in the theater and people were like, someone cried next to us. There was someone who was leaving. Like, it was, and it's not that scary a movie, but it obviously hit people the right way. But the brilliant thing about it was that they showed that trailer and then they had a thing at the end, a website to go to where you could demand it to see the film. It was like, I need to see this film. It needs to come near me. So they got more and more theaters to sign up and order it for distribution, which is brilliant. This movie did something similar that no one had really done previously, where they started to do almost immediately these daily diaries that were intended for YouTube and for the internet. They had filming diaries, which you can watch the entirety of on YouTube if you want to see the whole thing. But like from the readings, they're hosted by Simon Pegg and Nick Frost being like, hey, this is what we're doing. These are all the fun things we're doing. This is the scene we're shooting today. That wasn't a thing. And they kind of pioneered that concept.
It makes sense. I mean, this is such a fan-based culture that these films are a part of in terms of, like, I remember when Shaun of the Dead came out, I was living in Halifax, and, like, I only knew about it because of, like, the comic book store. Like, the people who worked in the comic book store in Halifax were obsessed with the idea of Shaun of the Dead coming out. So it really, that kind of, like, bring your potential fans, because they're not fans yet, the film hasn't come out, like, bring them in early on and make it, like, a subculture, I think works really well for Edgar Wright films. Because he's such a cinephile and because he's such a nerd and because he's, you know, he's able to convey a sense that, whether it's accurate or not, that he's just one of us.
I was actually just thinking that. He's one of us, right? Like, if I could just do blank, I would do it. But I'm glad there's someone out there just like me who's doing it.
Yeah, yeah. And I mean, I love the fact that the Nick Frost has this crazy movie collection, and it's pretty much just Edgar Wright and Joe Cornish's movie
collection.
Yeah,
their own DVDs. Like,
which is like, oh boy. Yeah, you're right. And actually, when you think about it, I think Edgar Wright has maintained, I mean, I think his films are usually fun. I go see them, but they're not necessarily always killer. I think he's maintained a lot of goodwill more as like, you know, an ambassador.
He's a nice
like
guy.
Almost like a nice Quentin Tarantino, you know, and he's got a great Twitter. He loves talking about movies and just talking about other people's movies. I guess like Steven Soderbergh, too, has that weird website where he just loves talking about other movies.
He made a genre for super film nerds, which is admirable, I think, and has been like riding that wave quite well. I also want to say how much I enjoy the amount of paperwork that occurs in this film. Like, I love that was also something he really worked out with Simon Pegg and Nick Frost, that it's like what all these action films that we're mimicking never show is the reality, which they talk to many actually police officers in interviews to do this film, just like how 80% of your day is actually sitting at a desk filling out incident reports, and how you would never see that in Bad Boys 2. That's never going to happen. But I love that they kind of make that gentle little like winky. And this was filmed in his hometown, right? In Wells.
Sure,
destroyed his hometown.
I trust you. Mm-hmm.
I know that there's a lot of, we talked a little bit about the influence, but the other influence I see on this small town village sense is a TV show called League of Gentlemen, which—
Oh man, that show's something.
Yeah, there's that idea of keeping the outsiders out and everything prim and proper, and Are You Local? That's a deep cut TV show that would have been on BBC in the late 90s. I see a lot of that in Hot Fuzz.
Yeah, I can see. And that show is like deeply disturbing, especially the second season.
Much.
The second season, that second season's so rough. Well, obviously, we're just doling out the recommendations today, Alicia. This is something that people are going to be like down rabbit holes for weeks, I'm sure. No, it's great. They're just going to get more references and understand where Stephen Moffat came from. That's all very exciting. So when we come back, we're going to look at a movie that Denzel Washington deeply regrets that he turned down. And it would have been a very interesting film with him in it. But that's coming up after the break.
Hi. I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
This segment of the podcast may as well be subtitled American Capitalism and the Terrible, Horrible, No Good, Very Bad Day. In 2007, we, of course, were on the brink of financial catastrophe. We were just starting to see the signs of it. But weirdly, the movies we're going to talk about today knew what was going on. And there's an interesting event that happened in 2007 that I was aware happened, and I knew the names, but I didn't know the details or how the whole scandal worked.
Newspaper publisher Conrad Black, I think at the time no longer a Canadian.
No, so this is one of the details I love about him is he lost his Canadian citizenship because he got into a personal scuffle with Jean Chrétien over him wanting to take a British title. And Chrétien is like, if you take the title, you can't be Canadian anymore. And he was like, I'm out, gonna go be a lord.
A very crunchy, like, ancient law battle between two fancy guys. But, you know, you don't want to cross Chrétien in that Shawinigan handshake. So, you know. But yes, anyway, Conrad Black, who at the time was in America, perhaps his first mistake, perhaps Lord Black would have done better elsewhere.
Jamie Lee Curtis notoriously says that she gets more tables as Lady Hayden Guest than she does as Jamie Lee Curtis.
I mean, we all know Countess Luann. She really lost it when she's no longer a contestant. So.
Is that a real housewife?
Yes, it is a real housewife. It's one of the only modern former countesses I know.
It's the only season I watched.
Oh, yeah,
New
she's
York.
Great. Sorry, money can't buy you class, as we learn from Conrad Black, he was convicted in 2007 on 4 counts of fraud in the U.S. District Court. Quite a lot of it was thrown out, but he ended up really being nailed for obstruction of justice, which I think works pretty well for both of these movies, which are essentially obstruction of justice thrillers. Mm-hmm. He was sentenced to 42 months in prison, even after a bunch of that was thrown out in appeals. So he was you're going to have to help me with this, Becky, because this is also, you know, much like these two movies, these are films that I think when I first watched them, a lot of the business aspects, I was like, way over my head. I was out of university and it was way over my head. So he essentially was diverting funds for personal benefit. It's the usual kind of embezzlement.
It's embezzlement
stuff.
For all intents and purposes. Yeah. Because they were selling off large portions of their newspaper empire, but they were pocketing large portions of that for themselves that they were not reporting, et cetera, et cetera. It's income tax.
Don't know in Canada, he started the National Post.
And still writes bylines for it, I believe.
Yeah, he wrote a great...
From prison?
No, he's not in prison. He's out.
He was pardoned by... Okay, this is... Cam's going to get into this.
Oh,
this is
I'm not
going to
get into
like,
you can go ahead. Go ahead.
Oh, man.
These are the years I was living in the U.S., I think. Okay. No, 2000... Well, at least his upcoming...
Well, he was in jail in the
U.S.,
if that helps.
Yes. So as someone who has a lot of money, he was able to appeal and appeal and appeal and appeal. And this went all the way up to the Supreme Court.
Yes.
The Supreme Court was like, okay, no, you are guilty. We are going to say that you are guilty. We're going to just give you time served. He was originally going to be put away for like 12, 13 years. And then he ended up doing something like 42 days. Like, it's ridiculous. And then eventually he was pardoned by Donald Trump in 2016 personally. So he's been pardoned of his charges. But he is also Donald Trump's biographer and one of his good buddies. So that's
And also among all of this, he was deported back to Canada, interestingly. He is our problem. I believe he lives on the bridal path. It's kind of a strange situation, but you get it. And it's kind of an interesting thing, too, which will lead into the movies that we're talking about. And I think quite a lot of the financial crash of 2007 is that it is a rich person who reaches the level of kind of richness that capitalism can get you, but wants more rich. Like, yeah. I need more money. Because, and the truth is, what both of these movies show is, like, to exist beyond that makes you a criminal. And some of these movies show it makes you evil. Like, that is the difference. You can be a rich person, but the difference between being a rich person and being evil is just never being satisfied with what you have.
And making that leap into sociopathy where you genuinely just don't care about other people and that you are literally having them murdered, which takes us into our first film. So the question here is, what if the writer of the Bourne series of films was to make a prestige white-collar crime thriller? What would it have? Would it have time jumps and explosions and frantic conspiracy spewing? Because that's happening. But how do you really get the word prestige in there? Well, you're going to cast a bunch of people who look fantastic at black tie award shows, like George Clooney, and of course, our show favorite, Tilda Swinton. Tilda won the Best Supporting Actress for her role, and in her Oscar acceptance speech, she has one of the best opening lines I think I've ever heard.
I have an American agent who is the spitting image of this. Really, truly, the same shape head and, it has to be said, the buttocks.
It is quite the contrast from the humorless and morally corrupt character that she plays in Michael Clayton. Also sweaty. Gerard Depardieu levels of sweaty.
One of the sweatiest on-screen characters, I think. Introduced as sweaty. Introduced as completely having destroyed her shirt. And a great way to show all these characters are introduced with a mystery, essentially. Tom Wilkinson, you're like, why is this guy raving like a maniac? George Clooney, why did his car blow up? And Tilda Swinton,
it's the time jumps.
Why is she the sweatiest freaking out woman in a bathroom stall?
Because she's the devil incarnate.
Becca De Mornay in the bathroom stall or Tilda Swinton in the bathroom stall? What's the better bathroom freak out?
I mean, it's a Freddy versus Jason situation I'd love to see.
An alien versus Predator. Yeah. Whoever wins, we lose.
Okay, so what's Michael Clayton about, guys? Obviously, Michael Clayton, but not really.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, Michael Clayton is essentially, it's a thriller, as you say, about a fixer. A fixer who works for a law firm. The law firm has been funded for a long time by essentially Monsanto, a massive agrochemicals corporation who's in the middle of a decades-long lawsuit that has been funding their books. He gets drawn into all of it because Tom Wilkinson, who plays one of the high-end partners, has a mental breakdown in a deposition hearing, strips naked, and declares his love for one of the plaintiffs.
Played by Merritt Weaver.
Everybody in this movie is a great actor. And it ends up kind of being this weird story of Tom Wilkinson, of Merritt Weaver, who weirdly sees this declaration and partially believes what he's saying, of George Clooney, who's the fixer, who is brought in to fix this problem, and of Tilda Swinton, who is a kind of mid-level executive of this agrochemical company, who has access to more evil means and decides to head down a dark path as she's freaking out that this is gonna, they're very close to settling this lawsuit, and she will do essentially anything to finish it.
It's a lawsuit about chemicals that ended up killing people.
Yes.
Merritt Weaver's family die of cancer. It's kind of an Aaron Brockovich situation.
I think it's actually, like, again, it's a weird movie where you're kind of just given hints, but I think the chemicals made her mother sick and her mother committed suicide, I believe.
But her brother did die, right?
Yeah, from maybe. Cancer? So, yeah. But there's a note, I know, that her mother left. So weird. But I mean, this is a movie that, again, everything is very touched upon, very like barely known. You're filling in a lot of the blanks. George Clooney is really the main character. He's the titular Michael Clayton. You're finding out that he's in a massive amount of debt to the mafia. You're finding out that, I mean, we don't even know that's a mafia. It's to somebody who's scary. You only ever see their fixer. It's kind of two guys talking fixer
which
to fixer.
He also is fixing things for his brother in his personal life as because his brother is a recovering addict.
He has all these real strange, it's funny, the fixer, the, or the fixer he deals with of the mafia is Bill Raymond, who is the weird guy from My New Gun, a returner. But yeah, so it's all these different stories. As you teased, Becky, it's also the strange story of Michael Clayton trying to bond with his son over this book series / card game that Tony Gilroy, writer-director, was obsessed with. Because that's how he bonded with his own son. And that ends up...
Over, like, Magic the Gathering or, like, World of Warcraft?
Yeah, he said, like, children's books and, like, reading YA novels and stuff. So he ended up writing this YA novel and building the card game. Apparently it was a functional card game.
And had the books, like, illustrated and stuff like that, like, got an illustrator.
And that becomes a key because the kid weirdly connects with Tom Wilkinson, who's having, you know, a sort of schizo adjacent breakdown and really feels it all.
Yeah, he's stopped taking his medication purposely.
Yeah, because essentially Tom Wilkinson sees the evil that they're doing. He is the whistleblower from the inside. And it eventually becomes he's killed and Clooney slowly realizing just how evil everything is going on around him and having to decide whether he, the man who seemingly can truly fix everything, is going to fix this or is going to, like, let it burn.
This is very much a writer's movie, and it's something that a number of writers since, screenwriters, have cited as being, like, a big inspiration point or their favorite screenplay ever, including Vanessa Taylor, who wrote The Shape of Water.
And I thought I was super original in my love of Michael Clayton, although obviously it's a great script. But I was on a panel recently with like 10 writers and they were going down the line saying, what inspired you? And three people said Michael Clayton. I was like, oh, whatever.
It's impressive.
Oh, totally. And I mean, it's worth saying that Tony Gilroy is a part of a strange writing dynasty. His father, Frank Gilroy, won the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Awards for the subject was Roses, the film adaptation of which is currently on Hollywood Suite. His brother, Dan Gilroy, wrote Nightcrawler.
So they got some dark things going on in their family there with American capitalism.
That's incredible. And I think his other brother, John, edited this.
Yeah, he edited the movie. He's quite a big editor. And actually, his son is one of the actors. He's the guy at the copy shop that helps George Clooney. So it's a very unusual thing. And I mean, it's a script that I think everybody loved. It's funny. It's Sidney Pollack's second last film. And apparently he gave the script wanting Pollack to act in it. And Sidney Pollack's like, I'm directing this, baby. And he's like, no.
I am.
He's like, no,
you know,
this
do you
is
know who
mine.
I am? Sidney Pollack.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, and he's obviously casting Sidney Pollack because Sidney Pollack's this kind of icon of paranoid thrillers.
I think Pollack ended up producing it in some fashion as well.
Yes. Yeah. Actually, it's a crazy... you know what? I think the script went around because it's like Pollack, Spielberg...
Like, Anthony Minghella every producer and Steven Soderbergh are all producers.
Oh, so yeah. That's crazy. So,
and Tony Gilroy had been around forever working on screen stuff. And actually, his work on The Devil's Advocate is what made him get the idea for this because he was studying a bunch of law offices and there was all these inner sanctums. And he was like, what's going on in there? Like, what evil
also,
are they plotting?
He also wrote, in 1982, he wrote The Cutting Edge.
Yes, his first
film. The romantic ice dancing, believe, film.
Yeah, he actually, I think, really starts in kind of a women's film angle. Because it's that and then a TV movie and then Dolores Claiborne, which is kind of famously a great look at spousal abuse. Yeah.
And now he's worked on Rogue One.
Yeah.
He's in the Star Wars
and,
franchise.
He's actually the showrunner of, to get crunchy into Star Wars, he's the showrunner of the Cassian Andor series, which is coming out on
Disney+.
These
are words coming out of your mouth I do not recognize.
You might remember it's Diego Luna's character. He really wanted to touch Jabba. Touch Jabba.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, he is getting a spinoff series, which Tony Gilroy is writing.
Oh, man.
I have to say that I did not look forward to watching this film at all. It just is not a subject matter that appeals to me. And I think because it's a relatively new film, like so different talking about 2007 than talking about 1978. Yeah. I was just like, oh, okay, I'll leave Michael Clayton to last. Mm-hmm. And wow, is it a powerhouse.
Yeah, so good.
I can't stop thinking about it. I can't stop thinking about Tilda Swinton. She's never been nominated since.
Yeah.
But this is how could she not win the Academy Award for this? I've never that role. She is supremely evil but believable. It's
empathetic. That's the thing. It's like this is the difference between this and say Perfume. Yeah. Is like you get why she's making the choices she's making, even though she's turning evil.
Yeah,
and she gets and then she gets nailed at the end, and then you get that satisfaction.
And climax scene. My God,
it's also one that's like you know, it's not quite Hannibal Lecter, but it's probably up there, where I don't think she's in that much of the movie.
No.
She's probably in, you know,
25
yeah,
minutes.
Yeah, totally. So she uses, and it's funny because she is such an uncertain character. She is not, when we say she's like pure evil, she's pure evil because she's so wishy-washy about human lives, which is crazy. And I mean, it's interesting. It comes right at the same time as Julia, which is a very underseen movie that she's so amazing in, where she kidnaps a child. Mm-hmm. It is fascinating. She's never been nominated before or since. But it's such a great role. You guys are absolutely right. And
I think this is her ascendancy. Like, I understand why then she gets plucked by Wes Anderson. Mm-hmm. She gets popularized, I think, by this film and this Academy Award. Whereas when we talked about her in 92, she's very avant-garde. She's very indie
film.
Well,
and when Hollywood got her, they tried to turn her into an oddity. So she did Constantine, where she played an angel, like a very androgynous angel.
And Narnia,
where she's the witch, which was also supposed to be Michelle Pfeiffer, who turned it down. But yeah, she becomes this like, oh, she's weird looking, so we're going to put her in weird looking roles.
She's an alien. And she's an alien in this, but it's the best kind of alien, where you're just like, she's an alien because it's so hard. She is empathetic, I guess, but at the same time, I'm like, I can't imagine ordering the deaths of people that you know, but then also being okay with potentially an entire state of farms and agriculture having people develop cancer and dying, and all you do is get a tax write-off.
It's interesting because you mentioned Aaron Brockovich earlier, and this was like something that was very much in the early 2000s, because like in the late 90s, early 2000s, there was like a big sweeping EPA take on all that kind
of
stuff.
We learned about this stuff, that this was happening all the time.
But there, if you go back to the 70s, which this is very much a 70s-style thriller, like, and there's everyone makes comparisons to Parallax View, there's a Canadian movie called One Man from 1977, which I love, and I wish more people had seen, that interestingly stars Len Carreyrou and Jane Eastwood, people we talked about in our previous episode.
Sweeney Todd himself.
Exactly. And this one is actually about a TV reporter that discovers that this business is actually killing people in that same kind of electricity way, and they just try to destroy him. And it is an awesome movie. It's directed by Robin Spry. I can't recommend it enough. I just got
to
get
that
one. My little Canadian film.
It's
on the National Film Board, so it's available for free, so you can watch it there. It's
great.
We are
a great country for that reason.
Sorry,
alone.
America. We get this one.
Aren't we, though? But yeah, but it's just, it really does have that like meat and juice and feel of like a true 70s thriller.
Yeah.
And we don't make movies like that anymore. In fact, this film has been referenced as being the last movie for adults ever produced by Hollywood.
I mean, I like to think that there's more than that. I also think that this was a time where 70s film was becoming more and more respected. It's kind of a thing I feel like I saw throughout my film school career, where it shifted from like an earlier kind of classic film to now it's like, why don't people respect the 70s?
Yeah, I feel like 70s film in particular, like films like 3 Days in the Condor and all those political thrillers, and Parallax View is a great example from 74. It's like by 2007, it was kind of the point where it's like, okay, now the 70s are an era of classic film. Because when you're too close to a decade, like, you know, in the 90s, they weren't thinking 70s films were classics because it was only 20 years ago. In the same way that arguably in 2020, we're not looking at like 1999 and going, Beau Travail is a classic film. It takes like 30, it's that 30 year mark, I feel like, that we're comfortable with then saying, well, this is now officially able to be on Turner Classic Movies.
Totally. I'm so glad you brought up Beau Travail, because that's the movie that I yell about the most that people need to see. So thank you.
I think by the time you're hearing this, it will be on Hollywood Suite if you're so interested.
Indeed.
It's an interesting thing. And we find it all the time with Hollywood Suite, where I can often be like, this movie is 25 years old. And people are like, no, shut up.
No, I saw this in high school and I'm not old.
Yeah, exactly. But Michael Clayton, I also want to say, like, as much as this has those 70s feels, this is a bizarre film.
This is wild.
A film that is so subtle.
Yeah.
And so, like, I can confidently say I did not get this movie. Like, I watched it and enjoyed it, but there's no way I got it when I first saw it. And there's such weird things where, like, I mean, the whole thing is like that he manages to survive this just because he's like, sees some horses. And like, he has like a moment with a horse.
I still don't understand that, and I don't want you to explain it to me.
There's not really an explanation. And
why
there's a fascinating
is he out in that field with the horses?
So there's a fascinating thing where they CGI'd in Tom Wilkinson's apartment a photo of a horse as a concession to some producer, I think, to be like, This is why he's looking at a horse.
Oh my god! Because
he thought of the horse, but that still is a fairly mystical.
It's like
there's
Ang
a lot
Lee
of
moment. It's,
yeah,
it's
there's
so
a
bizarre.
Lot of like mystical Ang Lee, mm-hmm. and there's a lot of it chooses to dig into a lot of moments that are not necessary, like his relationship with his brother. That's such a nice thing where like when he is actually super beaten down, and this brother he's essentially mocked. Because not even because he's an addict or he has all mental health issues, it's just because he's like weak. Like he tells his son, like you'll never be like that because you're weak. But then he is the strong one when
he
Michael Clayton
saves
is
his ass.
In trouble. In the same way he is, it's just like Michael Clayton's been faking it. But I mean, the moment with Dennis O'Hare, we talked a bit about where it's like you don't need that scene. That scene is not a necessary scene at all.
It's a MacGuffin,
but it's great.
It's There's multiple MacGuffins, like the Hitchcockian.
Oh, yeah.
notion of a MacGuffin, especially in the beginning of the film, and especially because it is not chronological in its editing, that usually a MacGuffin pisses me off to no end, and I thought that they were essential to this film. This film, like, I was trying to think of something that makes it really unusual, and the end credits. I've never seen a film do end credits like that, where they're not really end credits, yet there's text. The film's continuing, and it's
like The Graduate. You know, where
similar.
Fit. Yeah, you're just supposed to be watching his face and be like, what is the final note? And I mean, the
super
ending
effective.
Is also you're kind of like, okay, well, he did this, but he's also
screwed now.
Fleeing too. Yeah. They tell him, mm-hmm. don't go far,
the FBI
and he gets
in a
car and drives away. So it's like, there's
which
so much.
Which we should say that the director is the cab driver. That's Tony Gilroy. Who he pays $50 to. That's his director cameo.
I mean, he doesn't have a shirtless photo on Google, but he is a very handsome man.
I'm looking him up right now.
Yeah. He could be a Clooney. But yeah, like, as you say, it's a very interesting role. And it's a role that was offered to Denzel Washington, as you said before. He turned it down because I don't think he got it. And he says he regrets it terribly because.
Yeah. Well, can you imagine? Like, then the movie dynamic also shifts if it becomes a black actor, right? Like, that becomes a very different commentary.
As the fixer, as someone who doesn't have their name on the partnership but was there from the beginning, that would have
different
politics.
Yeah, why has he been doing this job for 13 years and he's not a partner? Well, is race part of that, right?
Yeah.
Like, what's
good point.
Maybe it makes it a slightly better movie. And I also think
I just love Denzel, so I'm always open for more Denzel.
Yeah,
bring
exactly.
him on.
Yeah. It's also an interesting movie because I think it really changes the view of George Clooney.
Yeah.
You see George Clooney get a, like, up in the air is essentially Michael Clayton. He's playing, like, I guess there was, I'm like, was there before? And before, I guess it's Ocean's 11 and maybe
Syriana.
To an extent.
Syriana's before this, isn't it?
You're the only person that's seen Syriana.
Am I? Okay.
Syriana 2006. I'm looking it up.
I
think so.
I don't even know.
Looking it up and then accidentally hit. Syria, the Wikipedia.
I got 2005.
Listen, he was Oscar nominated, but
I think it's the same cinematographer for Michael Clayton and Syriana. I think there's a bunch of crossover.
But I just feel like from here on out, he has the role where he is the perfect man who can do anything, kind of, you know. And quite often it's like it is that guy sweating, you know.
Yeah.
It's the guy who has up until now, you know, been the man in the Nespresso ads, but now. his spaceship blows up or the monuments can't move, you know?
Or he's visiting Disneyland?
He lives in Tomorrowland.
He has some almost Hamlet-esque monologues that are so good in this film. At one point, I wrote it down and I can't remember the exact part, but he refers to this whole situation as having a patina of shit. Just like
so good.
I wrote it down because I'm like, use that, Alicia. Use that in a moment where you need to be authoritative.
And I mean, it's also great monologues. Every Tom Wilkinson monologue.
Oh, Tom Wilkinson.
Is so
amazing.
Good.
As much as, you know, this is Tilda Swinton's film, despite only being it for like 20 odd minutes. Tom Wilkinson, this performance is powerhouse. He's good in everything he does.
Well, the thing is, it doesn't feel like there's any fat in this movie either. Like, everything that's there needs to be there for some reason.
Svelte.
Even if you don't get it,
you're right.
And because there is so much, like, forward drive to it, like, even that Dennis O'Hare scene, which, God, I love Dennis O'Hare and watching him in that. And he was mostly a theater actor at that time. Mm-hmm. American Horror Story hadn't really taken him along for the ride yet. It's still, like, that scene itself was an Oscar clip. Like every single scene feels like an Oscar clip, you know? It's that sort of intensity and height.
Yeah, and it's worth saying, like, as much as we're saying, like, Tony Gilroy, the writer, and he's not much of a director. He's only directed three, four features, I think. It is also a very well-directed film.
Yeah.
Because some of these sequences, like, I probably forgot most of the plot of Michael Clayton, I'll be honest, but I will never forget the car exploding while he's looking at the horses. I will never forget the extremely disturbing murder of Tom Wilkinson, which is so businesslike.
Yeah.
And it's just the terrifying thing where, like, oh yeah, somebody can murder you and make it look like nothing very easily. It's nothing. So there are these sequences that are so memorable. And Tilda Swinton sweating, honestly. I remember that too, her being so sweaty. So it's like, it is also a very well-directed movie. And I'm kind of like, man, I want Tony Gilroy to direct more. Actually,
I want another one of these. That having been said, let's talk about prestigious directors who love actors and unfortunately will not be making any more films because you hear about famous film folks having less than stellar final film credits. So you can think like Peter Sellers in Yellowface in 1980's The Fiendish Plot of Dr. Fu Manchu or Don't.
It's a low point.
Yeah, Gene Kelly in the 1-2 punch of Xanadu and Viva Knievel.
Xanadu is a high point.
Yeah, Viva Knievel, we'll go with that. Although it's a lot of fun, it's not exactly a dignified send-off for Joan Crawford in Trog. But our final film of this season of the podcast was also the final film for Sidney Lumet. And I think it's fitting that we end our season as we began it. Before the Devil Knows You're Dead is his final film, even though it was not intended to be. He had another one in pre-production. I really like this movie, and there's a lot of really heartbreaking stuff watching this movie in 2020. So although I do recommend people watch it, that's the caveat of, like, there's some stuff in here now that is very heartbreaking. Aside from the fact it's a very difficult film.
Well, just coming back to your talking about actors that have, you know, kind of had a crestfallen end to their careers, you know, that syndrome definitely happens with a lot of directors we've even talked about on this podcast and in the TV show. Like, if you just look at Charlie Chaplin making Countess from Hong Kong in 1967, Hitchcock's final film, Family Plot, which I think it's cute. Certainly not what you would expect.
It's weird.
Yeah, from like this weird comedy.
Yeah.
Or something like Billy Wilder and Buddy Buddy in 81, Cassavetes and Big Trouble. You know, and for a long time, people said this of Stanley Kubrick and Eyes Wide Shut, which we have completely moved away from. Eyes Wide Shut is a masterpiece. But God, this is so far from the scenario with Sidney Lumet and Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. I had never seen this film until the podcast. This is quite the end of his career. For those who are listeners, I mean, hopefully you listened to our first episode of the podcast where we talk about The Wiz, which was directed by Sidney Lumet. That is not typical of his filmography, The Wiz. This is someone that would be known for Dog Day Afternoon, Network, Serpico.
12 Angry Men. He created the courtroom drama. Mm-hmm.
So yeah, his 1957 directorial debut is 12 Angry Men, which is quite impressive. He directed Murder on the Orient Express.
Where he hung out with Albert Finney, who's also in this film.
Yeah, and like for, you know, directors like Scorsese, when Sidney Lumet died, I believe he dies in 2012, you know, they really paid homage to him as the chronicler of New York as well. As much as we think of Scorsese doing that, he really gave that tribute to Lumet. And of course, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, it takes place partially in New York City, but also in the suburb of Westchester, which is where Michael Clayton also partially takes place. Mm-hmm. I don't know what's going on in Westchester, except there's a lot of rich people doing a lot of bad things. God, this film blew me away. I have a hard time getting it out of my system. I want it out of my system because it is very well made, very taut, very thrilling, but it's so depressing. That being said, I want everyone to see it. I don't want
it's stunning.
Yeah. Just the title itself, Before the Devil Knows You're Dead, is a wonderful title for a film. And most famously, it stars Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke and Albert Finney, as you already mentioned, Becky, who's incredible in this. And it's a white-collar crime drama about embezzlement. It's about when you do one wrong thing and then everything falls apart. Like, it's never ending with how many things go wrong. in this film. It's an early role for Michael Shannon, who is crazy in this film.
Yeah. He's so good. This movie did not get Oscar nominated for much, if anything, is just shocking to me, especially the fact that they had Johnny Depp nominated for Best Actor as Sweeney Todd, and you did not nominate Philip Seymour Hoffman or Ethan Hawke for this is wild to me.
I don't have a lot of background on this, but my sense is there was a very botched release schedule on this film. I remember it coming out in Toronto, and I remember not being able to see it, and I do wonder if that affected Academy nominations and ultimately voters as well. I'm not sure. But it is a film that in 2020, if you go back and look at respected film critics, this film was, if not their number one film in many cases, always in their top 10 for 2007. Yeah. So I think it just took some time to kind of simmer. It has a stunning score by Carter Burwell for our listeners who are fans of Carter Burwell. And if you're talking about, you know, performances from Philip Seymour Hoffman, it's this interesting scenario where you have an embarrassment of riches. Like, which one do you pick? It's Philip Seymour Hoffman. But that being said, there is an argument, I would say, that this could be his greatest performance.
I do always want to give him credit for the thing people forget of he's the bad guy in Mission Impossible
3. Oh, yeah.
Which is a pretty good.
Right. What year is Capote?
Capote is actually the year before, too. 2005.
So, and he was nominated for that. So this is Philip Seymour Hoffman as he works for, is it like, I don't even know what company he works for.
It's like
for,
a property management bank or something. Because there's some aspect of like, Ethan Hawke is like a super of a building within the company. So there's got to be something related to real estate.
And ultimately, it doesn't matter. He's been embezzling funds from the company for years to fund his lifestyle and also his heroin addiction. His wife is Marissa Tomei, who is having an affair with his brother, played by Ethan Hawke. Ethan Hawke needs money because he's divorced and needs child support and spousal support and tuition.
And he's also made the choice in this like series of bad choices that his daughter needs to go to the most expensive private school, which he has to pay for. And then she also does not understand what money is, so she keeps asking for more and more stuff, and that leads to a heartbreaking moment later on.
The scene where she wants to go on a field trip to the Lion King and needs $130 and he can't give it to her, and she calls him, I can't remember if she calls him a piece of shit, which is something that her mother has called him while she's in the apartment, is heartbreaking. Yeah. But they decide to, because they both need money, these two brothers, to rob their parents' jewelry store in Westchester. That's a suburban mall, a jewelry store. And it all goes wrong, and they inadvertently kill their mother and then have to hide the fact that they are actually the people behind this crime. It is shocking. Only Sidney Lumet could do this. This is a mile-a-minute film, and much like Michael Clayton, not only does it take place in Westchester, but it is non-chronological in its editing, so you're always trying to piece together the film like a puzzle. And it's each character kind of gets their own segment where you get to see what they were doing when this robbery took place.
It's got that Rashomon-y sort of element to it.
Yeah, it is. That's a good point. It's a little Rashomon-y. That's a new term that we just coined.
But it is in the way like that it goes back to the same scenes, but you understand them from different angles.
Yes. What's interesting is the whole family goes to see Ethan Hawke's daughter's school play, which is King Lear.
Because that's how fancy this school is, that 10-year-olds are doing King Lear. Yeah.
But in terms of that, you know, the father and King Lear's father-daughter, but the father-son relationship and how that's really at the crux of what this film is very King Leary. Mm-hmm. It is also got one of the meanest white-collar drug dealers I've ever encountered on film. He's a pretty interesting character. But seeing Philip Seymour Hoffman's character addicted to heroin, I think is kind of what we were alluding to describing this film earlier, where this is a very hard film to watch because of the tragedy in Philip Seymour Hoffman's death and overdose. It's Leonardo Cimino's final film, for our listeners who don't
Monster
know who that
Squad.
is. And he is good in this.
Yeah.
But Albert Finney
is unbelievable. Oh. This is, if you love Miller's Crossing, if you love that Coen Brothers movie, this is a very similar thing where he's simultaneously playing the hero and the villain, and it's all like this peanut buttery chocolate swirl of morality. Mm. It's wonderful.
There's such an unexpected body count to this film. I did not, again, much like Michael Clayton, I was like, oh, I don't really, I want to watch The Wiz again or Sergeant Peppers. I don't want to watch this. And then was, obviously my perceptions of what I want to watch are completely wrong.
You got Hairspray. You got Hairspray, Alicia.
Yeah, I was like learning my lesson of like those films because my partner, Brendan, loves this film. And I would never be like, yeah, it's Friday night. I'm feeling like, let's watch Before the Devil Knows You're Dead. Yeah.
Not quite that.
But I want to say it's a must see.
Like we talked about with Michael Clayton, it's so many good actors. And Sidney Lumet purposefully, for the most part, filled it with theater actors, many of whom who would go on, like Michael Shannon, to be bigger. Amy Ryan, this is the same year as Gone Baby Gone, but she plays Ethan Hawke's ex-wife.
With that having been said, I actually want to hit some of the theater connections of this, because it was rehearsed for 2 weeks like a play, start to finish. They had they built them like a black box set so that they knew exactly, because it's not, I mean, they're also shooting out of chronology too. And that's a way of working that just doesn't happen in Hollywood. And it's something that top-notch actors like Philip Seymour Hoffman, who loved to act, can really sink their teeth into.
2 weeks, 12 to 6 every day. You know, we ran through the whole film on its feet at the end of the 2 weeks. And it was a great experience because anyone in the film, you really did have a good, strong, base to work with. So you were able to move quicker. Very few takes. He really sets up quick.
And so I think that's why the highs and the lows are hit so beautifully in this, because they know where they are in space. When this script was offered to Philip Seymour Hoffman and Ethan Hawke, it was originally Philip Seymour Hoffman and then Ethan Hawke got involved. Sidney Lumet asked them, which role do you guys want to play? And it was almost like a true Westian where like it was possible for them to switch roles every single night because either of them could have played either of these parts.
And Ethan Hawke apparently led on that. He wanted to play. Sidney Lumet was very shocked that he wanted to play the loser.
But, it works perfectly.
Yeah, exactly.
I know there's it could be apocryphal, but there is a story that, so Marissa Tomei in this film is nude most of the film.
Quite a lot of it.
I will say, it's impressive.
She looks great.
She looks
stunning, stunningly beautiful woman.
She, it's like, like Renaissance painting. It's, I'm not going to, I'm going to shut up about that particular angle, but to make her comfortable, because she was actually close friends with Ethan Hawke and Philip Seymour Hoffman, who, and she has sex scenes with both. To make her comfortable, Ethan Hawke demanded that the crew all strip down naked while filming those scenes so that it was like an equality thing. And I think that that is, coming to your point, Becky, about this being so theater based, like those kinds of tactics are unusual in studio films, and but obviously work really well.
So weirdly, the apocryphal part of your story is that they were close friends, because they weren't. They knew each other. They were all New York people who ran in the same circles, who knew each other, who professionally had wanted to work together for a long time, especially Ethan Hawke and Marissa Tomei wanted to work together. But they didn't really know each other particularly well. Philip Seymour Hoffman and Marissa Tomei were closer. And when the first day of rehearsal was, because it's the opening of the movie, that sex scene where he is having sex with her very graphically and very passionately. We shall say. And she's actually the one who took the lead on that in the rehearsal and said, okay, Phil, hop on. And off they went.
There's a good Sidney Lumet thing, because he's like, when I wrote the script, he's like, it can be very hard to negotiate that level of nudity and sex. And he's like, one thing that is very hard is like, if you don't make it clear, then you can get into a bit of a fight or somebody gets bashful. And so he's like, the script was nude, you're naked, it's nude. And like, the sex is wild. So yeah, but he said he was quite, he figured there would still be a level of negotiation and discomfort. But he's like, obviously Marissa really read the script.
She's a professional. I really love her.
Also, a very fascinating Sidney Lumet thing I love is Marissa Tomei was somebody he wanted to work with for a long time, because he tells this story of, he super loves My Cousin Vinny, number one, which is great.
As he should, because it's great. Yes. It's basically a comedy Sidney Lumet film.
Yeah, and number two, like, you got to keep in mind that My Cousin Vinny is like the early 90s. So Sidney Lumet was he'd been a director for most of his life, a great director, new actors. And he said only twice in his life, he's like, sometimes you see a performance and you're like, wow, they got that. They found that person. They got a non-actor. They are that person. And he said only twice in his life has he ever been tricked. And one was Tim Robbins in Bull Durham. He thought he was really that guy. And one was Marissa Tomei. And he shook her hand at the Oscars and was like, well, wait, you're not her. You're not Mona Lisa.
You don't have a Long Island accent.
Yeah. So he said that from then on, he's like, God, I got to get Marissa Tomei in a movie. She's the greatest actress of all time.
I also love the way there's a great story that Ethan Hawke tells posthumously of Philip Seymour Hoffman's death. Unfortunately, I think he was telling it in like 2015 or 16, where he says that he would watch the dailies with Sidney Lumet. Sidney Lumet would just go on and on about Philip Seymour Hoffman being like, he's the next Brando. Like, I've never seen acting like that since Brando or the intensity. And then at the premiere, he was talking to Philip Seymour, and he would get like a little, you know, jumped up about that, about like, well, what about me? And when he talked to Philip Seymour Hoffman, Philip Seymour Hoffman was like, did he bring up Brando? He's like, yeah. He's like, he says the same thing about you.
<that's>
was playing them against each other.
Yeah. And in all the interviews, he's, considering Marissa Tomei has quite a smaller part, he's very into, and I mean, I think, also, it sounds like she is very in the process he uses. Because like you say, part of what everyone says, and it's funny because Albert Finney said it was weirdly exactly the same in 1970 whatever on Orient Express. You practice and you practice and you practice, and it's partially so Sidney Lumet can fly through filming like a maniac.
Wow.
Like it's just set up. You're done. Sidney Lumet said that Marissa Tomei like took him aback because he's like, she could pull out something different and he would be like, God damn it, another take. Because he's like, every time I did another take, Marissa Tomei did something good and different. And I was like, please throw me off, Tomei.
It's lunch.
Like, yeah, how do you have 9 different ways to interpret this scene? And he says his favorite scene is one that is very subtle, which is Philip Seymour Hoffman and Marissa Tomei together in the car.
And
he kind of breaks down. And he says that's the best acting he has ever been involved with as a director.
That is an incredible scene.
More movies with men talking about their feelings openly, please. Because, man, that and him and Albert Finney.
Their daddy issues, specifically. Yeah. More
well, men him and Albert Finney sitting down and talking where Albert Finney tries to apologize to him is just like, oh, my God. Yeah. That one is, that's
but
real
then
rough.
Ends up slapping him in the end.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah, there's some issues there. I do want to bring us back into the script because Sidney Lumet also altered the script. It was a script by Kelly Masterson, and it was sold, and Sidney Lumet got a hold of it. He changed it. He made them brothers. And this is a story which I think is, it's a little sad, but apparently he was referring to Kelly Masterson as she while he was on the Junket trail repeatedly. And Kelly Masterson is male and identifies as he, and had to write him a letter being like, I met you on set. And so that's a bit like, oh man.
Keeping in mind that he was, this is not an excuse for misgendering, but 82 years old directing before the
Double Nation. This is also a bit rich for misgendering because this is just a guy who looks like a guy. But Kelly Masterson's kind of a strange guy. He's a playwright and was almost a monk. And his other big credit is the English script for Snowpiercer. Which you would never expect. He worked with Bong Joon-ho. Again, you're like, you kind of try to find the threads of this movie and you're like,
It's interesting because the way we talked about the host and all of Bong Joon-ho's films, including Parasite, like the disillusion and dysfunctional family is always at the heart. That is definitely what this film is. Like, I see maybe, like, I don't know what the time period is if Bong Joon-ho saw Before the Devil Knows You're Dead.
Oh,
it was
like,
I need someone
it
to...
It is possible.
Yeah, I could see this really appealing to his sensibility of stories and filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
I do want to just finish this up by saying that I love the fact that we're ending with Sidney Lumet because he is a man who made 44 features in 50 years. He invented entirely new genres. And one of the things I have loved so much about this show and about doing this season and this podcast with you guys is that I've discovered whole new things I did not know existed. And I'm hoping that our listeners have found the same thing. So I want to ask you guys, Cam and Alicia, what film was like the biggest surprise for you guys, or what's the one that like you really think is the takeaway of this for you guys?
Oh man,
we watched 46 movies. So
yeah, well, you know what? I it's gonna maybe be a jaw dropping shocker, but I think that the biggest surprise for me was 1492 Conquest of Paradise. Which
what was the surprise that you survived it?
No, I think that I figured that the Columbus films of that era would have let Columbus way off the hook for his indigenous genocide. And I think that the fact that people were that tuned into it back then really surprised me. I also think it was considered famously a terrible movie. And I don't think it's that terrible. I think if you're a Ridley Scott fan, why the hell are you not watching this movie? It fits all the other ones of his historical epics.
I think it's our most funny episode.
Yeah, I mean, I was very interested to learn so much. But yeah, I mean, the movies I like in this that I would recommend you run out and see are the ones that I already recommend to everybody I know, which is The Long Day Closes, I think is one of my favorite movies of all time. And also, I really, you know what, revisiting Wreck really holds up. Yeah, it's really one of the scariest horror movies I
thought
think
we
I've
agreed
ever seen.
That we would never bring up that film.
Too bad. Alicia, you're gonna have to watch 2-3 and Apocalypse. There's just no way around it.
It's just happening now. We're actually gonna program for season two of this podcast. We're gonna program way more horror. It's
every year from here on out is a different Wreck year, just to screw with you.
All right, Alicia, how about you? What's your big get?
I was very surprised at my reaction to Sergeant Pepper's Lonely Hearts Club Band.
I was wondering if you were gonna say that.
Yeah. Not that that should be the film that everyone runs out and sees, but that is a film that I would never have written into the show. And it it just slotted into the podcast really easily. But I think it's a cult film that I have like discovered for myself. It's something that I can put on in the background. And we've had it on Hollywood Suite a number of times, and it'll probably come back. So, I mean, watch for it. But also, it's not the easiest film to see. And I would say The Wiz, coming back to Sidney Lumet, rediscovering. It was really important for me to rediscover a film that I know I saw at 5 or 6 years old, and to compare how I saw it through the eyes of a child versus a very cynical and jaded film critic now. But yeah, I think, and if I had to say go run out and see something, it'd be Orlando for me with Tilda Swinton.
I think for me, obviously, I want everybody to see Eagle versus Shark so we can be friends, obviously. But the big surprise for me here was Just Another Girl on the IRT, because I was not aware it existed, number one. And then number two, like just the shock that she was not able to make a second film. I'm so glad it's getting a restoration and a redistribution. I love movies that make me yell at the TV because it often means they're surprising me. And that movie is so charming and so surprising. And I really can't get enough of it. And I really want more people to see it.
That's a good one. That's a good choice.
All right. That is everything for a season one of the A Year in Film podcast. Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much.
Thank you, Becky.
Cameron Maitland, thank you so much.
Thank you. Right back at you.
And this
thanks
is just,
wise.
And this is just a reminder that season two of the TV series is currently airing. And we're going to be back soon with season two of the podcast and more movies. But the TV series has stuff like Howard the Duck, Dog Day Afternoon, which if you haven't seen it, see it right now. I believe it's on Hollywood Suite. One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. And of course, one of my favorites, Ginger Snaps. Oh, man. If you haven't subscribed yet to the podcast, make sure you do so you'll be notified as soon as we're back. Again, thank you so much for listening. It has been an absolute pleasure. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to chat with us and find more great content? Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. The home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. Uncut and commercial-free on 4 HD channels and on demand. Learn how you can subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Kevin Lipset. Until next time.
Wait, it's a swarm.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.